Good evening. Thank you for having me again tonight. My name is Gyoke Yokoyama. I'm from the last name you can tell in Japanese. How I became American 2022. Yeah, 22. Yes. And I can say it, right? I'm like a supporting teacher for ACZC, Angel City Zen Center. And I'm still trying to figure out what that means up to today. So, yeah. And I work for this Japanese American, well, I shouldn't say Japanese, I mean, it's just a Buddhist temple in East Los Angeles, a fairly small community. While I serve Soto Zen organization, which is in a North American branch office, one of the branch offices, which has headquarters in Tokyo. So I sometimes represent the voice of the organization, and I sometimes represent the voice of the local folks back to Tokyo. And then my other work that I do is I'm trying to build a small community in my own small community in Canada. And while connecting with this, all these teachers in Canada, trying to create a Canadian Zen Association based on the American organization, which also is something I'm part of. So, because I'm one of the, now today, a few Japanese who are involved in the mainstream American Soto Zen movement, and there's a bit of a revival movement happening in collaboration with American teachers and Japanese teachers. So anyway, nutshell, I'm just doing an extension what I used to do in Japan, which was exchange program of the students. So if you're not that, what I'm doing is not that different. So today I was asked to talk a little bit about rituals, because I can see how Dave, after the first Ango training in Japan, is bringing in more of those elements. And I'll go straight from this bottom line. I think this is where I hear, this is where we kind of tend to settle. So I put down a word as a meaning of rituals in Soto Zen school as embodiment. That's often the word we use. If koan practice is about kensho, awakening, maybe I can safely say Soto Zen practice is about embodiment. Individual embodiment, collective embodiment. In Japanese community, we often use the word living out the teaching. You can talk about it, but how are we living the teaching? I'm sure you hear this kind of thing often as well. So it's actions than the words that speak more. And then in our kind of a community, we have a word kuyo, which is a central thing in the ethnic Buddhist community. Ku means offering. Yo is literally can be translated as cultivation. So in this kind of rituals, we dedicate to the deceased, offering some sweets, tea, sometimes even money. It's just a way of respect, flowers. And then it seems so much of, maybe I used to feel it's too much of offerings after offering after offering. And then I wasn't really happy when I was a kid. Like, okay, I understand we need to be respectful, but isn't it too much? Isn't it too much of formality, too much of structure? But then essence here is the we are dedicating this, our own cultivation of mind. So it's the, in Soto Zen school, there's this word called Gyoji Memmitsu. That's another thing that one of the first things you learn. Rinzai school, where they talk about awakening, Kensho, sometimes look at Soto Zen school and says, well, you guys are just, have this fine garments. You look sophisticated. You are so obsessed with small, tiny movements. And then and maybe I mentioned the word, you guys are like stage performers. And the truth is, there was a young Buddhist monks who left the head monastery after a full training and started to do a little fashion show. Little interesting fact in all the movements. And we met people, young folks, who get intoxicated with this movement, saying, of course, they don't say it, but look how well I can do this. So there seems to be a little bit of a delusive, like a delusioning thing that you can smell from this sort of thing sometimes. And yet, Gyoji Menmitsu means Gyoji is a practice, or including ceremonies or practices, Zazen. Menmitsu means thorough. So everything has to be very precise, detail-oriented. I put this down, a Sandai Soron. It's just something we hear commonly. Back in 1267, after Dogen passed away, his first student, Kon Ejo, took over the temple. And his intention was to continue Dogen's essence, the Buddha Dharma. And there was a strong movement. So let's just call that a conservative movement, or adhere to Dogen, which actually kind of resembles some aspect of North American Soto Zen lineages. There's just Dogen, just Shobo Genzo, just his message. That's it. And there's another movement at the same time who's responding to the community's request. Can you guys open up the temple? Can you guys start to do things that are somehow, you know, make sense to us, or somehow we can appreciate? So there was a voice, the liberal movement, and there was a split right after Dogen's death. So there's a little bit of a twist in the history right after. And Keizan's name, we're actually promoting as an organization. He was the savior to this chaos. He settled this whole split. And why I brought this up is the next word, socially engaged Buddhism. This is something I contemplated on a lot. I mean, when you guys come to Zen community or practice of Zen, you have some sort of reasons, and you're looking for that subtle but very solid kind of sense of connections with the absolute that is sort of beyond our relative thoughts and things. So there's something that you sense, something that keeps bringing you back to the practice, which you can't quite describe. And it's a bit of a letdown when you come to this practice and people start talking about, well, this is how you line your bells, this is how you hold the stick, ring the bell. And then from my experience, I had this kind of a fancy idea, but there must be some meaning behind it. Remember the karate kids? This is how clean your floor. And you do this over and over, and suddenly your body is moving. Like, I was looking for something like that. So looking for the meaning. Like, there must be some secret. Well, yes and no. You probably know, yes and no. But we do pay attention to these details. Yes. This is also prevalent in Japanese culture itself. So I noticed this when I translate for this, to represent different cultures. Here in the US, we do tend to talk about something bigger. This is how we kind of deliver impact to the society. This is how we tackle the homelessness issues. This is how we tackle this issue that's surrounding the environmental challenges. I think it's true in Japan, but we do hear things slightly differently. If you talk about this, let's say, environmental thing, we start talking about, this is how we unravel the plastic bottle. This is how we separate these things. This is how we sweep this corner of the room, and this is where you put the spoon. So you realize, like, okay, but I want to be talking about the world, not the bloom. <It's> like, so there's this kind of a temptation. And yet, you experience the same thing if you go to the monastery. Like, I came here for this set of mystical, very subtle teachings. And then they keep telling us, the slippers are disarrayed. Put it back. I was like, okay. And I think your colors, you're not aligned, so fix it right there. I was like, okay. So I keep fixing this. And I am not exactly a detail-oriented person. So, like, I even got frustrated. Like, okay, so what does it have to do with this deeper understanding of how things are? The body approach is typical of Soto Zen school. And there's so much emphasis on coming back to the body. And I think I read in the Science magazine at one point that our intelligence is not just from this, but it's actually, there's some, see, I'm not the researcher again. So I remember encountering some articles that what we consider as intelligence involves the entire body and bones, muscles, and all this. And there is a strong emphasis in Soto Zen school that the embodiment is not centered around here, but it has to accompany this, the whole body. And I thought it was interesting. And that's sometimes why we talk about people in Silicon Valley who's in the IT industry does come to Zen practice. And I wonder, we sometimes wonder if it's because of that, the body. And that's where the Zen practice is somehow aligned with the Eightfold Path. So it's not just, we're not talking about prajna, we're talking about patience, we're talking about this whole holistic body, mind. It's not just the mind. If anything, we start with the body and the mind will come. I used to go to Catholic and Protestant churches when I was just not so happy about this whole body approach, because I've met people who can do everything in such a refined way, who is a complete jerk. And I used to resent this, saying, okay, it's fine. People can do things physically so well, but he's such an, sorry for the language, but a-hole. Like, I don't get this. Like, and that's an interesting aspect of our school. We tell people, this is what you do. This is what you do physically. This is how you ring the bell. But how you want to cultivate your mind, it's entirely up to you. So people used to think that it's the most strict part of Zen training is just enduring this pain and having to sit still or having to listen to all these things like 24/7. But for me, the most challenging part of Zen practice was we have the container. We have the body practice. Now, how do we cultivate the mind? They're not going to come and tell us, this is how you cultivate your mind. And that was the harshest thing to me. And that's why I kind of had to step aside a little bit, step away for a while. Okay, now how do we do this? And I do feel the pioneer generations, 50s and 60s, who encountered Soto Zen in the United States, immediately saw these blind spots. And they wanted to do something about it. So that movement and my personal experience coincides right there. Socially engaged Buddhism, this caring nature, Thich Nhat Hanh's teachings, I think all that kind of is, I feel it's like a little wave of movements that covers this thing, or at least fills this, what I thought was the gap. Now, here I'm talking about rituals. In Soto Zen organization, there's this textbook called Gyoji Kihan, Standard Observance of Soto Zen. Well, it's rituals. And it has this thing, goes all the way back to Hyakujo Zenji. That's before, that even includes Rinzai Soto and China. And his instruction is the basis of everything we're following. And in Keizan Zenji shared a lot. A lot of things we're doing as rituals are based on this. And we have this kind of a form. Like, example is like if I take off this raksu, a simplified robe, we hold with both hands, we lift this up, use these three fingers, put these two fingers in, hold this up, and then move your hands like this, and lift it down, put it up, and place it down. And something like this, something very simple as this. If you want to put it on, use these two fingers. And then something like this is always there. If you want to hold this, kaishaku, hold this left hand, you hold this still. Use the right side. That's how you make the sound. So every simple things have some rules. And there's a textbook that we follow. Some people get completely stuck or inflated. I've seen that happen, something that happened to people's mind. And then that kind of makes some people say, hey, look, we are on the better side because we know how to do. And I've seen that happen to people's mind. And I've seen people who are following these rituals shaking. I think he was close to 60, a monk in Japan who's been serving the temple, but he had his main job working for the city office, something like that. And when he comes to the temple, he's just so wary of how everyone's watching and it's kind of shaking. And I felt there's just something that I have to wonder. There was a time I tried to take rituals, left foot, right foot, as a mindfulness practice. That was my own way of infusing the meaning to it. And it was just a way to make myself happy. It has nothing to do with it. All the rituals that we think, just like the bell we hear, is highly practical, at least used to be just perfectly practical. So when I share the forms with the other monastic students, I start right away from demystifying these forms and rituals. It looked like you're watching some Shaolin monk making this form, but no, it's just simply a function. So if you hear the bell, just consider that as an ancient version of walkie-talkie. They're just sending a signal, and you have to see that as a function. So if you put any dreamish, like a dreamy idea about, oh, this must have some sort of mysterious meaning, cut that out. No, that's not what we want. Understand that it has some meaning in relation to everything else happening to the temple. This form, movement, even this gassho or shashu, happens in relation to the robe that we wear, which the sleeve goes almost close to the floor. So you can see why our hands have to be lifted this height and this way. And it does look a little strange when we have this regular clothes. So this is in correspondence to what we wear and the situation and what's happening in the temple. So what we are actually developing in this sort of ritual is something very simple, very mundane. Like if you wake up, instead of thinking that, okay, somehow something wonderful happened, no, go check your email, respond to the person first, or make sure you pay the bill the next day. And this is pretty much what this whole ritual is teaching us. Don't delude yourself. Don't think that somehow something will happen. No, this is all based on what we embody in relation to everything else. So that's the container part. And there's a thing that I personally think that I share. Gyoji Kihan is a textbook. And there's another thing called Kuden. Sorry, I forgot to put the pronunciation, called verbal transmission. That comes immediately from your teacher. Sometimes that's very unique to your own lineage. If you go to different community and you see other people doing slightly different things, and we don't say, hey, that's not the way the school is teaching. We say, oh, that's your temple culture. And so that's another aspect. There's a typical thing that confused me the most called dengu. It's just a simple action of passing over offerings in circle. So we bow at the same time with the people behind you, whom you can't see. And you receive this offering at the same time as somebody else in the other corner is doing. So I was so confused, and I don't know how many times I got screwed up. But then this, to me, was just a source of frustration. Dogen personally left this message to his students that you do this passing of offering as if you are handing down or transmitting the Dharma. So there's a subtle nuance Dogen left. And just that's just one example. One thing my grandfather was really strict about was if you're an officiant, don't move. Don't you move. And if you move, move as if you are a rhino or you're an elephant, or I've been using the expression tortoise personally. And if you are jisha, as an attending monk, move like a hummingbird. That's my original. So each person has a certain function and move according to that function. And then if you're an officiant, move accordingly. And if you are the person at the door or tech guy, do so accordingly. If you're in the kitchen, do so accordingly. And that's what we get educated. We just learn. And if you're in the zazen, do so. I threw in these words because I had this whole rebellious phase in my life. Like, I don't want to do any of this. This is bullshit. Sorry, I grew up pretty, what do you call this, selfish. I was the youngest. So because of this experience, I had a conversation with people from Jehovah's Witness about birthday party, wedding anniversary, graduation ceremony. Because if you know about Jehovah's Witnesses culture, they don't do, or it's not like they don't do it, but they are very careful about the special occasions and about not doing so. And you might have some your opinions, but I was just very curious about why you choose not to do this like thing. And then when I had this conversation, was at least I had a conversation with 10 people from Jehovah's Witness side. And they're very respectful, by the way, to other religions. As far as I knew, I met people with. That they are very careful about not getting caught up with this idea of, oh, here's a birthday party. And there's some other ideas that comes in. Here's a Christmas. So we have to do this. And just twisting of motivation. So every day could be a birthday. Every day could be a special day. But that I thought was very interesting when I had this conversation. And forms could be taken the similar way. Sorry, the forms that we see in the book, we can easily get caught up. We can easily say, hey, we did everything by the book, so therefore, we must be doing fine. And there are some mistakes about this. And also, like, I think this is all bullshit. Let's not do it. And I'll say, yeah, just ignore it. Kick the zafus, you know, leave the door open. You know, pick your nose, just do whatever you want, and then see what happens. Why rituals? If you go there, if you see people meticulously aligning the offerings, meticulously aligning the angle of the cushions, you would like to think, but no, this isn't it. This isn't what I came here for. At least that's how I thought. I wanted to talk about society. I wanted to talk about human rights. I wanted to talk about the suffering. Form and emptiness. You know, we talk about this. I wanted to talk about emptiness so badly. I wanted to talk about the absolute. And there they are, emptiness. Now the forms, we've been talking about this forms. Tangible. What you touch. The tiny little things about the angle of your color. Instead of this whole worldwide issues that we are facing. What does it have to do? The school challenges us interestingly with this idea of form is form, emptiness is emptiness. It does to me, just a personal experience, open up a little bit of a path, avenue, to face our own aversions and attachment. Because we do. We have our own agendas. We have our own way of looking at the world. What rituals challenges us, I mean, there are a whole bunch of ways to interpret this, is what does this putting this wooden clapboard right up near my knees have anything to do with the action or of the society, you know, that we are taking for the society? So there's a little bit of a deeper way to engage in this tiniest, most subtle, most mundane actions or practice that we engage in and not differentiate it from how that impacts the rest of the world. So that's where I kind of want to stop.
Thanks, Kyoke. I appreciate the talk. This is something that I think about a lot, and I've talked to Dave about as well. Something that I'm curious about your thoughts on, I feel like we all naturally have our like proclivities to certain things, like our strengths and our weaknesses, things we're drawn to, things we're not. And Zen seems to be a tradition that likes to throw people into everything and break your strengths and break your weaknesses. And I just think that's interesting. I feel like I grew up with this notion that you should play to your strengths and, you know, face your weaknesses. But I don't know. Zen seems to kind of want to smash the thing all together. And sometimes that confuses me. So maybe you can unconfuse me.
Thank you. Unconfuse you. I may even confuse you more. I felt, I just to be honest with you, the experience at least back in the, 1999, 2000 that I saw, it's kind of like a bureaucracy itself in the monastery, because they shuffle the roles a lot. Like your position gets shuffled, and then they supposedly they don't care what we're good at, and supposedly they don't care what our background is. So we leave behind our backgrounds. If you're computer programmers, if you're teachers, if you are martial art teachers, they say, well, that has nothing to do with the Zen practice. You leave all that behind. Now you're just a monk with everyone else, again, supposedly. And then the way they assign us to do the different work is like supposedly, I'm using it over and over because sometimes reality is different. To do the task that sometimes you're not good at. People sometimes start to play safe. I've seen that. They wanted to not to cause trouble, not to stand out, because if you do, like, you kind of get in trouble. So I saw that, let's not do that. Let's not take a risk. And then, like I said, I pretty much grew up, I was in 15, 16, 17, I was exposed to the Western culture. So when I went there, it was 2021. So I felt like the whole motive kind of got taken away. And when I left the monastery, I felt like a really hollow, empty person. Like I just need a structure that I can kind of hang on to so that I can just keep going. I felt like I lost that engine that I had internally. They do that. I felt terrible. And maybe I felt like maybe I didn't do this right. They do that. And I often wondered. But in retrospect, I mean, it's been so many years. They do that. And then they come back to us again asking, what is it that you really want? What was that word? Really, really want to do. What you really, really want to do. So yeah, I guess so. That's like, so there's the thing that I want to do, and then they kind of strip that completely. And then when we are hollow and empty, they come back, so what you really, really, really want? That to me, that was the kind of experience. And of course they don't say that, but there's this whole thing. So then it gives a moment of questions. Okay, I thought like I'm good at this, and there's a whole negation process. Makes thanks so much for making me feel totally worthless. But then they come back. So what are you? What do you want to do? And then we'll come back to your true element. Oh, you know what? Maybe this is what I wanted to do. And then when they come back with that, it's the same thing. Like, we end up to be a highly egocentric person anyway, but there's something different about this. Again, I think I talked about this past in the past before, that we know what delusion is. We know what our inflated self-image is. We know what our self-narration is, at least partially. So we navigate our life based on this inflated, deflected or twisted image of our own self, and come back to your own center. What do I really want to do? It doesn't guarantee the skill set. and mindset, that's something you have to work on, because the school itself really doesn't guarantee. They don't really show you, this is what you have to have as a mindset, or this is what you have to have as a skill set. They don't do that. They just clarify that delusive part of us and just put us out there again. And without saying, they'll ask us, so what do you really, really want to do? So that's just kind of my answer. Sorry.
So when I asked you to talk about rituals, I kind of thought it would be hard to get you to talk about why it's good for people. Because when you trained me, you were very clear that it wasn't about me or what I was getting out of it. Which I was like, oh, that's what I'm getting out of it. I'm getting out of it the idea to drop that it's about me. But you talked all about how it was good for people as a practice thing. I don't know. Do you just want to talk about that difference between rituals as veneration of spiritual beings, as mindless respect for tradition, or what we're getting out of it? How should we balance our intention?
Yeah. The collective expression of rituals that we have in school definitely challenges our individual approach. It's easy for us to relate, say, hey, this is a cultural difference. And I mean, I come from Japan, so when I came to the States, I've been keenly aware of this Protestant culture where you want, as individual, you won't be aligned with the absolute. You won't be aligned with the truth as individual, not through somebody else. You don't want those advocates. It's you right here, our mind. And I kind of see that as a culture. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's, yeah. And in Japan, I'm not saying they're not like that. There's a subtle thing there. But the form of Soto Zen, as at least the collective forms that we have, makes us develop some sort of entrustment in others. Like, we want to be the one. Yes, it's there. I'm not saying it's not there. You have to give up that thing, alignment. But the way it's aligned comes through. So even the way we stand, like if I go to Zen centers in the U.S., everyone has given a chance to face the Buddha directly. So you have that direct connection with the image, the Buddha. You bow straight to the Buddha. And if you go to the Japanese temple, we face straight up north. Even if you're standing right there and the altar is right there, we're facing up north. And so you feel like as if your individual connection is somehow lost somewhere there. But we have this sort of intuitive, subtle sense that we are facing together. And there's this person who is representing us or doing this, but we are also doing this together. So this person standing there facing the Buddha's image, face to face, and here I am standing at the edge, facing some space where there's no Buddha's image, but then we are no different. So we do our own part, and then that's okay. That's the mindset. I mean, Zen practice is like you are here and then at the same time you're the whole. So like I can see how that corresponds with our own sort of, you know, it's personal and collective at the same time. But ritual is bowing, all this participation in this collective expression. We'd like to say it's no different, but our mind, it doesn't say so always. Our intention, there's no intention. The same with Zazen. There's no intention with that same of Zazen, right? Then how do we engage? Everything, all this super meticulously detail-oriented preparations, the way we conduct things, we do it that way with the understanding of emptiness. So none of that might not work as planned. It may totally get screwed up or not go as planned, but we engage fully. I don't know, to me, that's the first word I said with the Kriyo of cultivation. We are dedicating a cultivation, no matter how it unfolds. So we do our best without some sort of a wishful thinking. I mean, there is aspiration, there's dedication, but we have this very tangible, very specific way to engage. So even from the entering the hall, we enter from the left foot on the side, and then we take one side step as soon as we enter because there's another person right behind you usually. And because of that, even if there's nobody, we tend to take one side step, and people are like, why did they take that step, side step? It's, you know, I don't wanna make it glamorous, but I think non-intention is possible without getting caught up with the forms. But then you follow this thoroughly without pushing them aside, away, or overly attached to this. It's not the teaching, but this is just what I observe in the Soto Zen school itself as a community. Attachment does happen to the forms, and the aversion does happen. Typically, people who train in a bigger temple say, hey, this is how we learned. And then when they look at the people who don't do it exactly as they've learned, like, why aren't they doing it the same way? And that's where I find it's really interesting how Soto Zen has two head temples who have a complete, not completely, subtly different forms. And they're confusing each other all the time, almost intentionally. So we learn one form thoroughly, and we move on to another monastery. And we show off that skill. Gosh, they give you a hard time. Forget that. And then you learn a new form again. You learn that form. Let's say if you're more, you know, say diligent, you want to move on to another monastery and say, gosh, you have to start that. I mean, there's a basis of all the forms with all the differences. It's more like a foundation, a mindset almost. So once you get it, you immediately adapt. You just jump in. You do exactly how it happens in each community. But so it requires both attention, dedication, just cultivation, and at the same, letting it all go at the same time. I think that's how its whole training method is almost designed. That so non-intention, that, you know, makes sense.
Yeah. Thank you.
We run entirely on donations here, so if you can donate, please do, and if you can't, please don't. That's the system. If you want to donate online, you can go to our website also.
What's the best way to support us?
The best way to support us is to become a recurring member, is to become a member, yeah, so that you do like a monthly donation. Yeah, that's all I remember.
Okay.